This is Ed Zollars with the Lascalzo Institute, and this is this week's Current Federal Tax Developments. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look again at issues of reliance. It seems to be a topic we keep discussing in recent weeks. We're going to look at what you can rely on, and two of our developments this week specifically deal with whether or not reliance was allowed. We'll start out with a discussion of the IRS warning their agents about relying on items published on the IRS website. We'll talk about the IRS's transition over to getting user fees paid for on pay.gov for certain items. We'll then talk about a case where a taxpayer reasonably relied on a tax professional to escape penalties, despite the fact the professional made a number of errors. And finally, we'll look at the fact that the IRS issues their first notices of certification in the CPEO program, something we've been waiting on for a while. Well, we're in that season again where it's time for continuing education. And those of us here at the Lascalzo Institute, we offer educational courses via the state societies in a number of areas, both accounting and tax. We have a number of courses coming up at the end of June in Massachusetts and New Jersey. I want to go over some of those here with you today as we start moving, and this is probably about the time frame you'll start looking for those courses. On June the 28th, they'll be in Waltham, Massachusetts. Marcy Thomas will be leading a course in Nonprofit Industry Update and Gap Refresher. And that same day, Don Cochran will be teaching a course on estate and gift taxation planning and compliance in Roseland, New Jersey. On the following day, on the 29th of June, Marcy will move on again in Waltham, Massachusetts, and teach the course for compliance auditing from start to finish. Ken Heeslip will be running the 2017 FASB and AICPA update in Jamesburg, New Jersey. And Don Cochran will move over to Iceland, New Jersey, and have an all-day course on the multi-state taxation of business. Finally, on the 30th, the end of June, we'll start out with Marcy Thomas, still in Waltham, will be teaching a course on risk-based audit standards, effective utilization. Jeffrey Christokos will be teaching a course on financial planning strategies for life wealth cycles in Jamesburg, New Jersey. And also in Jamesburg, New Jersey, Ken Heeslip will be teaching a course on planning for upcoming gap changes. These particular courses you can register for on the websites of the Massachusetts Society of CPAs and the New Jersey Society of CPAs. Also, check the other state societies for courses that are being offered by the Lascalzo Institute over the next few months. Now let's take a look at what's been going on and let's get into our updates for this week. And the first update is the IRS in SBSE 040517. I always love getting these long titles, -0030. This is a small business self-employed division memorandum to agents. This memorandum talks to agents about the use of frequently asked questions found on the IRS's website. As you've probably been aware, if you've been to irs.gov anywhere in the last decade, the IRS has taken to publishing guidance on that website in the form of frequently asked questions, also known as FAQs, or sometimes referred to as FAQs. So you'll see them referred to in any of those titles. These cover various topics. In fact, the IRS has a whole webpage devoted to the frequently asked questions as an index to them. And they cover things ranging from IRS procedures, filing requirements, itemized deductions, issues on retirement plans, estimated taxes, earned income tax credit, you name it. There's probably a set of frequently asked questions about it on the IRS's website. Now, of course, the question becomes, if you have something there that says this is how an item is to be treated for tax purposes, should we be able to rely on that statement? Well, the IRS has warned their agents in this memo that they should not use such frequently asked questions to sustain a position unless the FAQ itself explicitly indicates otherwise, or the IRS indicates otherwise by a press release or by a notice or announcement published in the Internal Revenue Bulletin. In fact, the IRS continues to remind the agents, and I'll remind you as well, that for sub-regulatory guidance that is binding on the service, that's going to have to be published in the Internal Revenue Bulletin generally. Now, I realize these days most of us don't actually get the IRB. Remember the old days, we used to get that in the mail all the time. They still publish it as a PDF on the website. But that generally means things like revenue rulings, revenue procedures, announcements, notices are the types of things that get in the IRB. And they're still there. If you go get the PDF version of it every week, you'll find those things sitting in there. Anything else like the frequently asked questions or the IRS publications are maybe helpful. They're probably right, but if it turns out that the IRS gives the wrong answer there, well, that's not binding on the service. And for those of you who think, wait, that's not real world. In the real world, that never happens. Go back to the 2014 case of Bolbrow versus Commissioner. That was that one rollover per year IRA case we've discussed a few times. Remember, the catch was, you know, if you have the one rollover per year where you take the money out of the IRA and you put it back in, you can only do that once per year. The question, Mr. Bolbrow had an account with, let's say, like Charles Schwab. You have a second account with Merrill Lynch. Can you do a rollover from Schwab and then still come back within that following 1 year period and take money out of Merrill Lynch and roll it over? The IRS publication said you could do that. Unfortunately, the IRS took Mr. Bolbrow to court and said you couldn't do it. The tax court agreed you couldn't do it. So if the rulings are in fact at odds with the law, they're not binding on the service. Now, this also caused the IRS to report that they're going to be adding a new section to the Internal Revenue Bulletin at 4.10.7.2.4. And the big thing that's going to be added there is a caution. The cautionary statement will state that the Internal Revenue Service employees must follow items published in the bulletin and taxpayers may rely on them. Some items such as FAQs can be found on IRS.gov but have not been published in a bulletin. FAQs that appear on IRS.gov but that have not been published in a bulletin are not legal authority and should not be used to sustain a position unless the items, that is the facts, FAQs explicitly indicate otherwise or the IRS indicates otherwise by a press release or by a notice or announcements published in the bulletin. So again, be careful. The IRS website, those frequently asked questions, they're useful, they can be helpful, but make sure that you check and ensure that anything you find there is consistent with what is binding authority. Don't just accept what's stated there because, as Bolbrow found out, you do that at your own risk. And it could be a costly risk. Next up, the IRS, we're moving to more automation. And in news release IR 2017-102, issued on June the 1st, the IRS announced that we're going to start having to pay various user fees via the government's pay.gov website. This is going to be required for things like private letter rulings. Officially, the line is any ruling that's covered by Revenue Procedure 2007-1. And that essentially includes private letter rulings, closing agreements, and rulings on forms 1128s, 2553s, 3115, or 8716. So if you have to go get a ruling on any one of those, like permission to change an accounting method on a 3115, not non-automatic for those form items, the non-automatic changes in those areas, you're going to have to pay the fee via pay.gov. Now, it is being phased in. So what's going to happen here is beginning on June the 15th, so coming up here shortly, they'll open up pay.gov. You can pay on the website. And from June 15th to August 15th, though, you'll be able to either pay on the website or you can continue to pay via a check or money order. However, any payment made after August 15th, so we got 2 months, right? Beginning in August 15th, the payments will only be accepted via pay.gov, right? Kind of an interesting thing. Now, one of the weird things about this is first, if you go to that site, you're going to notice you can pay all kinds of things there. So it's nice to get a copy of this news release to find the instructions on exactly how you can dig deep and find the actual thing you should be clicking to pay. And it tells you that you use the IRS, in essence, visit pay.gov, and essentially you use the IRS Chief Counsel user fee or supplemental user fee for Form 1128, Form 2553, Form 3115, Form 8716, private letter rulings and closing agreements form. That's a nice short list. You find that in a long list of forms. Or they suggest maybe you just search for IRS Chief Counsel user fees in the search the form box. And then you'll probably come up with this one. Now, you still submit the ruling request itself via the old-fashioned way. Pay.gov does not accept the ruling request. So now you're going to have to send proof of payment along with your ruling request. And you have to do that, print a copy of the completed form and receipt and include that with the ruling request. You can also hand deliver it. And they said for fastest processing, also fax a copy of the pay.gov receipt, the completed form of the ruling request, to the fax line at 877-773-4950. So again, if you're going to be doing this, you know, realize those things, you know, those changes are coming. Now, one important thing to note, while it does affect private letter rulings, it does not affect termination letters because the termination letters are not covered by Revenue Procedure 2007-1. They're covered separately. So for now, if you're paying a fee to get a termination letter, that does not go in via pay.gov. That's not going to be how you're going to submit that sort of thing going forward. Next up, we have the case of Whitsitt versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-100, issued on June 1st of this year. This deals with the penalty that we find under Section 6662 for our accuracy-related penalty. And in this particular case, we have a penalty that's triggered because there was a substantial understatement of tax. Generally, the two we usually worry about that is either negligence, if you don't have what's called a substantial understatement, then the question is, was the taxpayer negligent? Or if you have a substantial understatement, then all the IRS has to show is that you had a substantial understatement. For an individual, a substantial understatement is an understatement in tax that is greater than the greater of $5,000 or 10% of the tax required to be shown on the return for the taxable year. Once the IRS establishes that you've cleared $5,000 or 10%, remember, if we have to go with negligence, the burden's always on them to prove the initial requirements for a penalty. So they've got to prove negligence. But here, all they got to prove is the number, that your understatement is above the trigger limit. Then the penalty applies automatically unless the taxpayer can show that the underpayment did not arise from a tax shelter and there was substantial authority for the position, or the item was adequately disclosed on usually on Form 8275, 8275R, and there existed a reasonable basis for the position that gave rise to the underpayment. If you can't meet those two tests, the other option is there existed reasonable cause for the underpayment. The taxpayer acted in good faith under 6664C of the code, and the underpayment did not arise again from a tax shelter. Now, in reality, with those three exceptions, we rarely see the substantial authority rule work. Here's the problem. The agent has just asserted that you fouled up the tax computation and that you didn't follow the law. Agent's going to be really tough to convince you had substantial authority for your position if, in fact, the agent's already convinced you failed to follow the law. So it's an uphill battle. That doesn't mean you can't win that argument, but it does mean don't be surprised if it's going to take a lot of arguing to try to show substantial authority. The second one, adequate disclosure, reasonable basis, there is a little different. Generally, if you have an 8275 or 8275R on the form for the position in question, it's very difficult for the IRS to sustain a penalty because now suddenly you made disclosure. Now it's up to the service to convince the judge that there's no reasonable basis for the position. In that particular case, that's a difficult one to go. So most often, if there's an A275, suddenly the penalty comes off the return. Now, if it's a non-disclosed position, then generally we end up with this third category, the reasonable cause for the underpayment where a taxpayer acted in good faith. And quite often, the reasonable cause exception a taxpayer is going to go for is going to be that they reasonably relied on the advice of a tax professional. Right? That's the case. And in this case of Whitsitt versus Commissioner, there certainly was a major understatement of tax that ended up being involved for 1 year in question. Dr. Whitsitt had owned stock in a company And she had been, you know, she'd had the stock for a number of years. Actually, it was stock that she acquired. She and her ex-husband had acquired. She ended up with it in the divorce. The stock had split multiple times in the interim. Now we come up to, in 2011, she gets a notice stating that a company wants to buy the stock. And she basically decides, well, yeah, I think I want to sell. And she was going to get basically, in this case, about $1.7 million. Or I should say $1 million, a little over $1 million on her stock. And so that's fine. And she did get a check. Now, what was interesting, though, was the check. She got a check in January of 2012. The letter from the Computershare Trust Company, who was acting for the buyer, told her that the payment date was August 19th, 2011, but the tax year was 2012. They had a letter dated January 9th of 2012 indicating her sale was processed on January 4th of 2012. So now she has this document that says the sale was, the payment date was in August of 11, the tax year is 12, and she's got a letter and a check in 12. Not surprisingly, Dr. Whitsitt was a little confused by this as to, okay, when do I report this? So she gave all this information to her tax advisor. This advisor had been preparing her return for many years. In fact, had prepared it back before the divorce even. So it goes back many, many years. This particular advisor had been in practice for, you know, 25 years, had lots of experience. So the advisor took a look at this and he advised her the sale should be reported on her 2011 income tax return. Now that conclusion was incorrect. The sale actually took place in 2012 because that's when the payment was actually made. Dr. Whitsitt had no actual or constructive receipt of that payment in 2011. But we'll ignore that problem. The advisor missed that. He decided her basis was $639,000. Now, she'd originally paid $11,000 for the stock. For reasons that aren't totally explained, the advisor somehow concluded that she had reinvested her dividends in this stock, that it was, she had some sort of a drip program. So he took all the dividends that they had received on this stock from day one, taking it off of the old tax returns that he had, and he had them going way back, and he added them all up and included them as her basis. Unfortunately, there was no dividend reinvestment program, so the basis was $628,000 overstated, minor detail. He did tell her he needed extra time to prepare a return and prepared an extension, and she sent a check for $154,776 with the extension. He finally completed the return in February of 13, so late. He advised her he was going to electronically file the return for her, and he gave her a Form 1040-V to pay an additional $5,393. Except here's a little problem. Turns out that return was never actually electronically filed by him. Okay. Now she goes back to the same preparer to handle her 2012 returns. She gets a 1099-B in 2012, gives that to the preparer. The preparer concludes, oh, he was right initially, so he does not report the gain. Okay. Now, here's where the IRS starts sending notices now. First thing she does in December of 13, she gets a CP80 notice indicating that the IRS has this credit of $165,000 on her account for 2011, but no 2011 tax return had been filed. She wrote indicating her belief that the return had been filed electronically, and she sent along a copy of the 2011 return. A little bit, you know, a couple weeks later, she asked her preparer, well, should they send the IRS another copy of the 2011 return for processing? And she was assured that was not necessary because the preparer said he had filed electronically. Problem is, of course, apparently he hadn't. He has no evidence of doing so, we discovered later, too. In October of 2014, the IRS sent another CP80 form saying, again, look, we got all this money for 11, we have no return. Again, she sends a response in October 18th of 2014, the notice stating her 2011 return but filed electronically. But 9 days later, she gets her first notice on the 12 return. It noticed the missing sales proceeds on the tax return and advised her she had a tax due of just under 700 grand. That letter worried the taxpayer slightly. I think that's probably a good way to phrase it. So she sent the preparer both notices and asked him what was going on. He responded by having her file a prepare a power of attorney. Over the next few months, the preparer assured Dr. Whitliff by email he was talking with the IRS about her returns. Finally, in an email that was dated February 2, 2015, he indicated he concluded the sales proceeds really should have been in 12, and he'd prepare amended returns to file on paper with the IRS. However, he never actually delivered those returns. In April, the IRS issued a proposed notice of deficiency for 2012, looking for $541,000 of tax and an accuracy-related penalty of $107,000. Dr. Whitliff now decided something had gone really wrong, and she went out and got another advisor, an attorney, who agreed something had gone really wrong. The attorney prepared a revised 2011 and 2012 return. 2011 return, which was filed, right? It was the first return filed, asked for a significant refund, not surprisingly, but asked that it be held and applied to the 12 tax. The attorney also, you know, filed in court to challenge the IRS's 2012 calculation because, of course, the IRS had assumed short-term gain, had assumed all kinds of things that, you know, not like they do on a CP2000 with missing, you know, when you have missing reported sales. So they went to court, and the attorney and the IRS agreed, finally got an agreement of what the tax was. There's no question. But the IRS insisted on assessing the penalty, stating it was a substantial understatement, and she should have known this. Dr. Whitliff should have figured this out. The tax court took a look at this, and it used the standard found in Neonatology versus Commissioner, 115 TC43. You're going to find there's a set of standards there. Now, she has to show that she acted reasonably, right, and in good faith. So the first thing the court says is, well, did she act in good faith? Because without that, we don't worry about whether she relied on an advisor or not. And the court decided she did. The court said, look, it would have been to her advantage based on time value of money to report this gain in 12. But she wasn't sure it should be 12, so she went to her advisor and was willing to get an answer that was going to be less favorable to her. In fact, she accepted that she had to pay tax a year earlier when the advisor told her that was the case. The court said that demonstrated good faith because she tried to, you know, properly handle her tax. So all of these things end up coming in. So we have this, we properly handled the tax. Then they said, okay, did she meet the three criteria in the neonatology case? First, she has to show that she found she had a competent professional who had sufficient expertise to justify reliance. She had to provide the necessary and accurate information to the advisor, and she had to actually rely in good faith on the advisor's judgment. The IRS said, look, that first line, no way was this guy a competent advisor. Look at all the errors he made. The tax court said, that's not the test. We wouldn't be here. Almost always, if we're in front of us and we're raising the question of reliance on an advisor, the advisor has made a mistake. The mere fact the advisor made a mistake is not the problem. The question was, did the advisor appear competent? In essence, did Dr. Whitsitt act reasonably in determining and finding what she believed was a competent pair, understanding her skill level? She's a physician. She is an educated professional, but she's not a tax expert. And the court found she did. She'd used this advisor for years. She had never had a problem with the IRS, you know, using him for a couple of decades. You know, as far as she knew, everything was fine. You know, he'd been in practice for a long time. He was a member of a lot of organizations that were accounting related. She had reason to believe he was competent. On the second issue, the IRS never questioned that she provided information to the advisor, but he agreed. But then the IRS said, yeah, but did she really rely in good faith on the judgment? Shouldn't she have known that the advice she was given was wrong? And the court said, no, she doesn't really, you know, let's face it, first, she took the less favorable answer, right? If the answer was wrong, it was wrong, but it was wrong against her interest in terms of year to report. And she still accepted it. That is, to the court, that was proof of good faith reliance. She didn't just say, you know, she's not one of those people who questions the advice when it goes against her only. You know, the advice went against her, she still relied on it. But the IRS said, yeah, but he overstated her basis by $600,000. Shouldn't she have noticed that? The court said, well, look, the original 4,000 shares been purchased in 82. She got them from her ex-husband in 98. Because of stock splits, they had mushroomed to 63,594 shares. And the advisor erroneously told her that she had reinvested dividends, and that's how she got her shares. She didn't know that his calculation was off. She had no reason to believe it was. Therefore, the court found she had reasonably relied on the advisor and no penalty was due. Finally, this week, the IRS has finally gotten around in news release IR 2017-103 issued on June 1st to sending out notices to the first certified professional employer organizations that are being come. The first certifications are out there. Now, for those you may have forgotten, because this program was established a while back, the CPE program was established at the end of 2014. It was by the law. The law passed in 14. The IRS was supposed to get this ready, and we're supposed to have CPEOs by the beginning of 2016. A certified professional employer organization, if you use one of those, you're a business, you use that to handle your employees. The advantage of using a CPEO is, you're going to transfer and these guys are going to pay payroll taxes on your behalf. Under current law and until we have a CPEO, if you transfer that money to the CPEO and then for whatever reason, or I shouldn't say CPO, the PEO, and the PEO doesn't pay the payroll taxes, you're still liable for them. And that's a big problem, right? Conceivably, it could be a huge problem if they're not being paid. We've seen a lot of cases where payroll services have run into financial trouble. We've seen those cases in the courts where a payroll service ran into financial trouble, didn't actually pay the payroll, or even worse cases where there was simple fraud, they were stealing from the employers. And the employer ends up getting stuck with having to pay the back payroll taxes yet again, have paid them once to the organization. Then again, if you use the CPEO, the IRS will no longer have recourse to go back against the business that hired the PEO, but rather will only have recourse against the PEO. Now, to be a certified PEO, they obviously have to establish that they are financially sound and they have to post bonds and do other things. That's fine. The IRS has now approved the first batch of 84 organizations. So they letters have gone out to those organizations. The IRS will publish on their website the names and addresses of these organizations once the IRS receives the surety bonds from the organizations. The IRS also says, look, we have other applications we're processing. So if you didn't get your letter, if you applied and you haven't got your letter, you were in the first 84 they gave, those other organizations that have already applied should receive a decision from the IRS, I love it, quote, in the coming weeks and months. Not sure what that means, or, technically 20 years from now is coming months. Those are months in the future. Hopefully the IRS means something shorter term than that, but just be aware that that's not much of a help if you're one of those who are waiting for the application to come in. The flip side of that, though, if you are an organization, a business looking to hire a PEO, obviously you're going to feel a bit better if you have a CPEO as opposed to if you just have a plain old PEO. And I suspect your auditors may feel better if you're having audited financial statements. Well, like we said to support, Lascalzo Associates, we're doing a lot of work with the state CPA societies, and we're beginning to see a lot of courses are now being offered. There are a number of states out there that have June 30 renewal dates, so there's going to be a lot of work to be done where you need to check your state society offerings. If you're in one of those situations and your license is up for renewal, it's time to go check and make sure you have your CPE. And if your state's not that way, Arizona's not that way, you still have to get your courses and you might as well check. We're running things right now. I'm going to be doing courses in Arizona and New Jersey this month. So go ahead, check your state CPA society for all the various offerings they have and check those both in tax and in auditing and accounting that's offered to you by the Lascalzo Institute via your state CPA society. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute for June the 5th, 2017. You can download a PDF that has articles with all of today's topics, read them follow up to have links to the cases. We have that information you might need about paying, all that crazy detail about how to pay at pay.gov if you're going to go get a ruling request. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Ed Zollers. And so until next week, this is Ed Zollers, and I'll be coming back a week from now, and we'll talk about the things that have happened in the coming week, in the area of federal taxes.